Good morning, everyone. We'll call the meeting of the Academic Research and Student Affairs Committee to order, and it's looks like it's about 10:01. And Winter, could you please take roll?
Chair Del Carlo?
Here.
Vice Chair Perkins?
No.
Regent Brown?
Here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
You do have a quorum.
Perfect. Thank you very much. And with that, we'll go to, I'll call public comment. I got to get my glasses, everybody. There's some really small writing here. All right. For those who would like to call in and offer public comment, please dial 669-444-9171 and enter meeting ID number 999-9889, 3151, and passcode 999-999. Is there any public comment here at UNLV? Is there any public comment? Yes. The floor recognizes you, Mr. Unger.
Doug Unger, D-O-U-G-U-N-G-E-R, professor, Department of English, and co-founder of the UNLV Creative Writing International Program. Good morning, Chair Del Carlo and members of the committee. I'm here to express my enthusiastic support for the SANS Institute for Chinese Language and Culture, which will expand significantly international focus and language acquisition opportunities for UNLV students. I've devoted 34 years to teaching and nurturing developing writers for professional and artistic success. Our program is unique in the world for requiring a residency abroad and study of literary translation as a curriculum requirement with demonstrable success. Writers who learn their art at UNLV are well known for dissolving barriers, blending cultures, combining and recombining what they have lived and experienced abroad into something new in their art when they return. The SANS Institute for Chinese Language and Culture will help our students reach out to, learn about, and understand China. Likewise, it will help Chinese students and scholars to learn about and understand the United States. Our students are looking forward to participating in the rich programs this new institute promises. As educators, I believe it is our duty to empower these exchanges and the learning they provide, also in hopes that precisely this kind of cross-cultural experience will be the most reliable, lasting means to overcome ideological and political differences and so transform our world for the better. The great Chinese modernist author, Lu Xun, wrote in his story, Guzheng, or My Old Home, "Hope is like a path in the countryside. Originally, there was no path, but once people begin to pass, a way appears. The SANS Institute for Chinese Language and Culture offers a new path at UNLV, a public-private partnership that promises to benefit us all. Thank you."
Thank you, Professor Unger. Is there any other public comment? And this is not being videoed out, correct? So we're good.
We're live stream, but now video conference.
Okay. Okay. So with that, we'll then go on to our consent items. We have two consent items, and it's just the minutes and the elimination of a program at NSU.
Sure. So, could you ask for public comment on the phone?
I'm sorry. Is there a public comment on the telephone?
There are no callers for public comment at this time.
I was going to say, after all those numbers, who would get it the first time around? I mean, geez, I was trying to say that really slow so you would get it. But anyway, thank you. And, you know, I have to say, I think it's really great how we do public comment because you have every means to do it in person, on the phone, or send us an email. And we got about 8 of them last night. So anyway, with that, I can go on, I think.
Move to approve.
Oh, thank you, Regent Brown. Do I have a second?
Second.
Second from Regent McMichael. Is there any discussion? No, we don't need discussion on that one. Consent. So all in favor of the consent items, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? There's only 3 of us. We all said aye, so let's move on. Okay, let's go on to turn the page. Number three, UNLV, Organizational Unit Proposal, SANS Institute for Chinese Language and Culture, and this is an action item. And with that, I will turn this over to Provost Heavey.
Thank you so much, Chair Del Carlo and members of the committee. I'm truly delighted to be here today to ask for your approval for the SANS Institute for Chinese Language and Culture. I think we all agree that ultimately institutions of higher education are about building a better future. That is really at the core of what we do, and this proposal today aligns incredibly well with that mission. As an institution situated here in Las Vegas, an international city with deep ties in the business and cultural realm to China, we want to lean into the space of trying to improve relations between these two great nations. And we're so excited to have this partnership with SANS Corporation to help us empower this new institute that will spur additional study in Chinese language, cultural understanding, and ultimately workforce development that will prepare more students to work in the intersection between U.S. and China relations. And ultimately, we think this will be a great contribution for our institution and on behalf of our city to the larger mission of trying to improve relationships between the two most important countries in the world today. And so we could not be happier to have this proposal in front of you today. I want to just thank a few key players who have been part of the long journey to make this happen. First, I want to start with SANS Corporation and CEO Rob Goldstein and Vice Presidents Andy Abood, Chase Whitmore, and Ron Reese, all of whom we've met with frequently and have their strong support behind this proposal, which is obviously shown in the $15 million pledge they made over 10 years to support this new institute. And I'm happy to say that the first $1.5 million contribution is already sitting at the UNLV Foundation, which is amazing. I also want to thank our lead partner institution, Sun Yat-sen University in Guangzhou, China. This is a premier institution in the Greater Bay Area of China. We visited them three times now, and they've brought a delegation out here, and they're excited to partner with us on this new institute. We also expect to work with Beijing Normal University in Beijing and Wuhan University, also two leading universities in China. I want to thank the Chinese consulate in San Francisco and their education councils and counselors who have been key supporters and helped us build this proposal and create these partnerships. And I want to name a few key UNLV partners, Professor Deng Honghui of Business, who has been with me in every step of this journey and without whom I would definitely not be where I am today with this. My Chief of Staff, Ms. Tondra Day, who has also been a key partner in this proposal, including the beautiful writing that you see in the proposal that's in front of you. I want to thank former Dean of Hospitality, So Shoemaker, who made the original introduction to SANS Corporation, and Professor Doug Unger, who is also here today and spoke in favor, who was there at the very beginning of the conception of this project many years ago. And, of course, I want to thank President Whitfield for his unwavering leadership and support in moving forward with this institute, even when some other institutions of higher education have stepped backwards from their engagement with China. And now, if it's okay with you, I would like to allow John Sandy, a representative from SANS Corporation, to say a few words in support of this proposal and about his company's commitment to this partnership. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Del Carlo, members of the committee. My name is John Sandy, and I'm here today on behalf of Las Vegas SANS to express our enthusiastic support for the creation of the SANS Institute for Chinese Language and Culture at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. As a global company with deep roots in Nevada, Las Vegas SANS is committed to advancing education, fostering cultural understanding, and building bridges between communities. The SANS Institute for Chinese Language and Culture represents a bold step towards these goals, offering students, faculty, and the broader community unique opportunities to engage with one of the world's most influential cultures. Las Vegas and UNLV are uniquely positioned to benefit from this initiative. Las Vegas saw a 573.3% increase in visitors from China in 2023, reflecting the growing importance of understanding and engaging with Chinese culture in our tourism, hospitality, and business sectors. The SANS Institute will provide essential Mandarin language instruction and cultural programming, preparing Nevada's workforce and students to succeed in an increasingly interconnected global economy. For students and faculty, the Institute will open doors to immersive learning experiences, international exchanges with leading Chinese universities, and enriched academic offerings, including the potential development of a full Chinese language major at UNLV. By connecting Nevadans with some of China's most prestigious institutions, the SANS Institute will enhance research, collaboration, and create pathways to global career opportunities in UNLV graduates. The Institute also aligns with the ongoing national efforts to strengthen U.S. and Chinese relations through educational and cultural exchanges, as highlighted in recent discussions between President Biden and Xi. By fostering dialogue and mutual understanding, the SANS Institute will serve as a global model for public-private partnerships advancing international cooperation. We are proud to partner with UNLV in the endeavors to support the university's mission of driving innovation, inclusivity, and global engagement. The SANS Institute for Chinese Language and Culture will be a lasting asset to the university, the Las Vegas community, and the state of Nevada. On behalf of the Las Vegas SANS Corporation, Ron Goldstein, Andy Boone, Chase Whittemore, and Ron Reese, I want to thank the Board of Regents for considering this important initiative. Together, we can build a brighter future grounded in mutual respect and understanding. And thank you for your time and dedication to advancing higher education in Nevada.
Thank you again to Las Vegas SANS Corporation for their incredibly generous support of this important initiative. Happy to answer any questions.
Okay, to my colleagues, do we have any questions or comments? Regent Brown?
Thank you. Regent Brown, for the record. I had an opportunity to chat with several people about this before we got here, and I just want to say I am so thrilled to see something like this. I think it's so important. I've had opportunities in my life to do exchange trips, and I've learned so much, and it's made me a better thinker. It's made me more curious, made me more empathetic, and I think that this is just one step towards making this institution a really good community pillar, and I want to thank the SANS Corporation for being strong partners in this. And I one thing I wanted to emphasize, I really enjoyed the PK through 20 model and how we're looking at this holistically, and we're not just focusing on students when they come here on campus. I think it's really important. I think this is a I think it's really great. So thank you.
Thank you.
Regent McMichael?
I too wish to thank the SANS. I think this is a wonderful collaboration between two nations, and this will go a long ways towards cementing relationships that will last for an extremely long time. Thank you.
Thank you.
I think there's just three of us today, but I want to say, too, this is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for this university. It's just a wonderful global outreach. We are world citizens today. We're not just Nevadans or Americans. We're all products of the entire world. And the more we can foster those relationships, the better this world's going to be for peace. And I see this program as being a way to bridge conflicts. If we don't learn from each other, we can't ever get ahead. So I really, really applaud UNLV and the SANS. And this is such a wonderful program. And I was talking to, I think, you, John, or maybe you too, Chris. I think you Las Vegas is the first one that went into China. And this is when our former Lieutenant Governor under Kenny Guinn, and I can't use her name publicly because I don't have her permission, but I think if you're in Nevada and you know who I'm talking about, she was the first one that went in and opened China to Las Vegas. And I remember at the time her telling me how many people of affluence, a huge amount of affluent people there, and what a great market. And then I believe, am I right, John? The SANS was probably one of the first to go into Macau. Did I say it right, Macau? And with that global presence. So, you know, I wish we could, as my colleague said, I'd like to see kids learn Chinese starting in first grade or a language. I think we're the only country in the world that doesn't start our children early in a second language. We expect everybody to know English. But I thought, Tondra, you did a beautiful job, right? If you're the one that wrote this, it was 15 pages because the whole thing was so well written. And it answered every question. When I get a briefing paper, I want to know the who, what, why, where, when, and I want all the why, you know, those questions answered, completely answered. And it was so well laid out. And I do remember last summer talking, you and I were talking, you were in China. So to me, this one's like a totally no-brainer. I mean, I don't know why we'd have any opposition to this. This will survive any political environment we have. And as I said, this is how we bridge divides through education. So I'm just so proud of UNLV for bringing this forward.
Thank you.
So with that, we'll, any other comments or questions from anybody? I will entertain a motion for approval.
Motion to approve.
Okay, Regent McMichael, we need a second for approval.
Second.
Thank you, Regent Brown.
Emphatically, second.
Yes, thank you. And all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
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 Okay, it passes unanimously. Thank you so much, and thank you for coming and speaking today, Mr. Sandy. Appreciate that.
Thank you again.
Thank you. That's great. Okay, we'll move on to item number four. This is Nevada State College Program Change, MS Speech Language Pathology. And with that, I will give it to, who's up there?
Sarah Fry, Provost of Nevada State University.
Yes, thank you. You're our president today, too. Yep. Thank you.
Good morning, Regents. For your consideration today, we are seeking a change in degree type for our graduate program in speech-language pathology. It is currently a master's in education, and we'd like to change it to a master's in science. This is for a number of reasons. First and foremost, we've received feedback from our students, prospective students, and our faculty and prospective faculty that this degree type is fairly unusual for the field. There's 319 master's programs in speech-language pathology in the U.S., only six of which are master's in education. Furthermore, our program's curriculum is aligned well with master's in science curriculum. We already offer clinical experiences beyond just those in educational settings. They're working in healthcare and other types of clinical settings as well. And so we're seeking to change the degree type to better align for prospective students so that they can identify the program. They're not restricted to working in education when they've navigated our master's curriculum, and also to help our prospective faculty as we're recruiting for new faculty to understand that this is a broad speech-language pathology program, not limited to an educational setting.
Okay, with that, do you, either of my regents that are here have any questions or comments? Yeah. Regent Brown?
I was going to say this makes a lot of sense, and I move to approve.
Second.
A second. We have a motion on the floor, so all in favor of the motion to change the MS speech language pathology, please say aye.
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 Aye. Anybody opposed? Well, nobody's opposed because we just all said aye. So this passes, and
thank
you very much. That was quick. I think we made up a little time on that one. Okay, with that, we'll move on to item number five. It's TMCC. It's a new program proposal for Associate of Science in Geology.
Good morning, Chair Del Carlo, Regent members of the ARSA Committee, Vice Chancellor Archer, Presidents, and she colleagues. My name is Jeffrey Alexander, Vice President of Academic Affairs at Truckee Meadows Community College, for the record. I come before you today to present our proposal for an Associate of Science degree in Geology. You may recall that almost 4 years ago, TMCC eliminated its former AS degree in Geosciences, which had faced enrollment declines due both to the pandemic and to the retirement of its principal longtime faculty member. When I came before you to deactivate that program, we pledged to bring it back in a few years' time. And as we were then on the cusp of hiring a new full-time faculty member with expertise in geology, I'm very pleased to report that that new faculty member, Roger Putnam, has joined our team, and he has consistently delivered instruction of such a high caliber that TMCC's chapter of Phi Theta Kappa presented him with its 2023 PTK Full-Time Teacher of the Year Award, and he has earned several other accolades besides. Bolstered by his exceptional teaching and outreach to the community, enrollment in geology has climbed over 30% since 2020, and our team has worked to establish a transfer articulation to the Bachelor of Science degree in geology at the University of Nevada, Reno. Given the statewide importance of our mining industry and the increased focus on lithium extraction, both DEER and the U.S. Department of Labor project a steady increase in geology-related jobs in our region, which totaled an estimated 20% increase between 2018 and 2027. Also, as we know, geological engineers and technicians are vital to our construction industry, which is working to scale up housing and infrastructure to support the rising population of northern Nevada. In his letter of support for our proposal, the Secretary of the Geological Society of Nevada, Joshua Miller, points out that more than a quarter of our nation's geologists, geological engineers, and technicians will be retiring in the next 5 years. And as he concluded, our program proposal will be crucial in supporting the professional geosciences workforce development needed to meet this challenge. Regarding budget, TMCC already has the instructional staff, facilities, and equipment necessary to deliver this program at the projected rate of enrollment growth through year five. Our college maintains a geology lab at its Dandini campus that is well equipped with ArcGIS software, and we have made recent investments in new teaching apparatus as well. Our staff and facilities are at the ready. Finally, in her letter of support, UNR Chair of Geological Sciences and Engineering, Dr. Paula Noble, affirmed that our proposal offers an important conduit for those wishing to pursue further studies at a four-year university in programs such as geology, geophysics, and hydrogeology. Dr. Noble concluded that our proposed curriculum will make transfer students ready and able to matriculate to UNR, and that it is precisely these partnerships which we should foster and support. With that, I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to take your questions.
Okay, colleagues, do we have any questions? Regent Brown?
First, I just have a generic comment of something that I've been talking about for a few months, maybe longer. What is time? I really want to see the system have a workforce gap analysis done so we can have some kind of data sets to show this. Now, with this particular case, I've done enough tours up north to know that there is jobs of the future embedded in here. But I'm just saying holistically, like, this is important to me because I don't like making decisions without something to compare it to. If we're not leading with data, then we're not leading to success. That's how I genuinely feel. But specific to this, I just wanted to confirm, so the 60 credits that a student would acquire at TMCC, will they be applied to a bachelor's fully? Meaning, like, there's nothing in the 200 level that is similar to a 300 level that they'll have to retake because there's not a similar, or because they're similar, I'm not going to say they're the same, but you know what I'm getting at.
Yes, thank you, Chair Giancarlo, to you and through you to Regent Brown. Thank you so much for that question. It's a great question. Yes, indeed, we have done that work to ensure that the program is articulated and fully transferable so that a student who completes these courses, specifically the geology courses that they would complete at TMCC would be 101, 102, and 210, and electives may include Geology 100. In that case, those courses and credits and the other gen ed credits that a student completes would transfer in full, and the student would step onto the UNR campus as a junior in good standing if they were, in fact, successful in all of their credit attempts. That's right.
Thank you. A little foreshadowing, but we will be addressing this in the workforce committee, so thank you.
Regent Michael, do you have anything? No? Okay, I was excited to see this, and the only question I really have is, this was dependent on a faculty member. Do you have backup too in case? Yeah, okay.
Great question, yes.
Okay, because I thought when you let the other program go, the geoscience program go, you said in the briefing paper it was because there was a faculty person left or retired or whatever, and then the program languished.
Correct. That is exactly right. In this case, fortunately, in addition to our full-time faculty member, Roger Putnam, we also have an instructor, Bell, who has delivered a great many credits for us and is a very accomplished geologist. All of our team members are master's trained in geology.
Okay, great. And I just think this is a great fit for the North, since there's no other community college offering geology, if I remember from reading the briefing paper. And the synergy with UNR, and I'm with Regent Goodman, I'm sorry, Brown, on that. I want to, you know, make sure that every 60 of those credits, they all seamlessly transfer. That, to me, is the value of a system and working together and having that collaboration between our community colleges and our universities, because this is a kudu to the student. They're going to save half their tuition by taking those first 2 years, and then that is going to really pay one whole year of their, if they go on to their junior year, say. That'll pay that year. So this is a great program. So with that, any other comments? I don't think. All in favor, please say aye.
I'll move to approve.
I got to get a motion first. I'm getting a lot ahead of myself. All right, may I have a motion from Regent Brown? And I have a second from Regent McMichael. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
I won't ask the rest because there isn't anybody else to ask. That approves. Thank you very much. Well, good briefing paper, too, on that one. And with that, we'll go on to item number 6, which is another possible action item, the NC Planning Report, the Academic Master Plan, and I'll give that to the Director of Policy, Tarina Caserta.
Thank you, Chair Del Carlo. Good morning, Committee. Tarina Caserta, Director of Policy. Today I have for you, for action, the 2025-29 Planning Report. This report contains the plan for the next 4 years and is prepared in accordance with NRS 396-505, as well as the handbook. It's a biennial report that is sent by February 1st every odd-numbered year to the legislature. The report's a comprehensive plan for the next 4 years. Any anticipated new program or expansion of a program of instruction, student service, or in some cases research, the anticipated cost of such program, and then the anticipated source of funds outside of state appropriation. In general, the report summarizes, the report before you summarizes those, the institution plans. What you'll find on that list are programs that are being discussed and considered, maybe currently being researched or will be researched for viability in the next 4 years. They may come forward, they may not come forward. It's a peek of what's on the horizon for the next 4 years, and ultimately, not every plan will necessarily come forward in the next 4 years, but could also be included on subsequent reports. These are plans that the institution hopes to develop and that meets the mission and the needs of the institution. And if you have any questions on the content of that report, so this is compiled from the institutions, if you have any questions on the content of any institution's report, then I would defer to the institution.
Okay, with that, Regent Brown, you have a question?
Thank you. I have less of a question and just wanted to say I really appreciated when I was reading the description that some of these programs don't get funded and they stay in there every 2 years for, you know, then they've been in there for maybe 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 years, right? Mm-hmm. I really just appreciate that we keep consistency in some of those things. Obviously, some things will sunset, we'll bring new stuff in, things will change priority, landscapes will change. But I just wanted to say I really appreciated the persistence and the continuity from report to report, showcasing, even if they don't get funded, that this is still a priority and that we want to advocate for it. So I wanted to say thank you for that.
Thank you.
Regent McMichael, questions, comments?
Just a comment. I appreciate that individuals take time and effort in formulating a plan for future inclusion up to 2029, and hopefully these plans took into consideration the possibility of reduced funding if and when the Department of Education is eliminated. And I hope that we look in the future and take this into consideration for any planning in the future. Thank you.
Chair Carvalho?
Thank you for the opportunity to chime in on this. I've, to be honest, struggled with this report a little bit because I feel like it really isn't communicating what I think we're supposed to be communicating to the legislature. I'm glad that others noticed something that I did in terms of certain programs carrying forward from report to report, and some of them have been on here for many, many years without really any discussion or consideration from this committee or from the board generally, which normally isn't the case. But I think it would be helpful if there is a program that is on this report that does keep rolling over to the next one, that's maybe put in a different area that says, hey, this is the reason why we haven't been able to figure this out, but this is why we think we still want to do it in the future. But for me, I wouldn't want it to look like we're phoning in this report to the legislature when you have some of the same programs on this report year after year, or every 4 years. The other thing is there are some items on here that are listed from previous years. So I feel like that's a little confusing to me, that this is supposed to be a look forward, but we have some programs that are looking back. And so I don't want to make it, and again have been on previous reports. So I think that there should be, I'm not trying to say that there isn't a lot of effort and work that goes into this, but I do feel that it is important to make sure that the report is fresh and new and forward facing, and for those items that carry over from report to report, that should somehow be noted so it doesn't look like we're just kind of putting the same information in report. In the report going forward. So thank you for the opportunity to provide my feedback.
Certainly. And I had some questions on it. Just does this go to the every legislator? Does it go to the education committee? Do you ever get brought in to go over it and explain it? Or is this just, I want to make sure you, the time and effort that you put into something, this is a long, huge report, that it is purposeful for them.
Sure. Thank you for that question. So let me break out that question. To answer the first part, it is sent to the director of the LCB, and that's done by February 1st each year for review. And so where that goes after it passes through the director, how that is reviewed, and then how it is distributed, I am not completely sure their process. But because it's required by statute, then they typically will publish it or they will link to our published report, so it is available for public consumption at any time, and then we maintain all of those past reports. And then we are open and available. Should they have any questions on their reports, then we would either answer that or defer to the institution to answer a question.
Okay, so Trina, so did the LCB ever call ENCHI and ask a question ever?
Not that I'm aware of. I've been there, Tarina Caserto for the record, sorry about that. I've been there 5 years, have not had a question come in on this particular report.
And it's by statute. Do you have the history at all when they asked for this to be, when it was passed and what the reasoning was for it?
Well,
Chair Del Carlo,
1967.
In, but just looking at the statute itself, it looks like an iteration was originally passed in 1967. And then subsequently amended in 1993. Okay.
Yes, it looks like passed. Thank you, Tarina Caserta, for the record. Thank you. 67 was added to NRS. revised in 73 and then again in 93.
Okay, I was just asking that because sometimes we do things because we've always done them, and this is a long time since 1996. I just want to make sure, you know, the effort you put into it is really useful. So in new business, I'll bring that one up, what Tarina, I think we should do.
Thank you. Tarina Caserta, for the record. I agree, and should the LCB determine they need additional information, then they would, my assumption is they would put that into statute, so then we would then codify that in board policy, and then we'd go from there also. So absolutely. And then the report is fairly comprehensive and does allow for some of this wish list, if you might say, wish list, to continue to pull forward if it has been determined that it's not viable now. The institution may want to continue to research that for future. And then the report also contains expansion of programs, which I think is always helpful, too. So thank you for those thoughts, those questions, and suggestions.
Okay. Is there any other comments or questions? With that, I entertain a motion to approve the report.
Motion to approve.
Okay, motion from Regent McMichael and a second from?
Second.
Regent Brown, for all in favor of the report as presented, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. It passes unanimously. And with that, we'll go on to item number 7, the new program review. And this one is information only. And with that, we'll turn this over to Dave Singleton.
Okay. So thank you, Chair Del Carlo. Good morning, everyone. For the record, David Singleton, Academic and Transfer Policy Analyst, and I'm here today to present the 2024 new program review. Unlike the last report that you got, this one is only required by board policy, Title IV, Chapter 14, and it includes information about the new programs that were approved for implementation in 2023, 2021, and 2019. So if you look at the report, the spreadsheets that make up the first three pages after the cover, just so you know, are best viewed on a digital device. If you print it out, the print on the second and third spreadsheets in particular can be difficult to read on a printout. Those first three pages are the estimates of headcount, full-time enrollment, and expenditures for each of the programs, and then you have the actual figures. So for the programs that started last year in 2023, you have the information, that's for the first year. For the programs that started in 2021, you have the figures from 2021 and 2023. And for those that started in 2019, you have the first, third, and fifth year figures. Again, both estimated and then actual for the information there. So that's kind of the quantitative portion of the report. After that, the second part of the report is qualitative narrative. Now, in the past, the institutions were only asked to provide more detailed summary for programs that had enrollments that did not meet projections. But this year, we decided to take a slightly different approach. We wanted the institution to try to address some of the concerns that have been raised in the past about variance from estimates. So we asked for narrative context for any program where there is a variance from the estimate of at least 10% in either direction, over or under, for enrollment or expenses. So that led to a little bit more of a robust narrative section for this year's report when compared to other reports. But we kind of hope that these narratives help provide more of the needed context for the figures that you see on those first three pages. The academic officers or some of their representatives from some of the teaching institutions are here if you have specific questions about some of the things that you see.
Thank you. And with that, we'll go to Regent Brown.
Thank you. And now I actually don't know if this is a question for the institutions because they might treat it differently. But when comparing first year, third year, and fifth year, just the three different reports, obviously they're different classes, but there are estimates versus actual FTE. And if the actual is lower in the first year versus the fifth year, are we making decisions, hey, that first year wasn't great, we need to increase advertisement for it, but is that conversation very different in the fifth year? If the FTE is still lower, are we saying maybe this isn't a program that fit is a good fit for our institution? So I don't know if that's a question for the individual institutions, but and I can give specific examples if that's helpful.
I think it's probably a question for the institution because they may need to make that decision internally. And so if you have a specific question about a specific program, then I think you may want to discuss that with that institution.
We can start with UNR.
Are they here? Because I don't know if they're here.
Well, great. They get to be an example. there's a couple of things on this chart where at year one, they've had one FTE actual where they were projecting 15. Obviously, this is a different class. But then we have, you know, the estimated count. But then in the opposite, right, psychology was they thought they would get 130. It looks like they have 430. So I'm curious what they do in the reverse. And then if we go to year five.
And it may be program dependent. And, I mean, one of the things to think about might be, again, depending on what kind of program it is, mm-hmm. the recruitment strategies may be different. And so they may need to have internal conversations about what the advertising looks like, what the marketing looks like, mm-hmm. what the outreach looks like, and thinking about what the students look like. Because, again, you can build the program, right? But there's the other side of it, which is, are the students going to want to be in that program?
I was told if you build it, they will come. Since I was a kid. I'm just kidding.
Which does happen. Right. You know, and I mean, WP consultants did say that, but.
I'm being flippant. right. Yeah, I guess my question is, after 1 year, obviously, you know, if, again, I'm going to go back to if we have that workforce gap analysis, we could actually say, hey, the year one didn't work, but these are jobs of the future. We definitely need this. What is our recruitment strategy? Versus a 5 year of still having less FTEs significantly, by the time you get to 5 years, if we had the workforce gap analysis, or even if we don't, what is the responsibility from this side of the table to say, hey, 5 years, your FTEs still aren't matching. What are we going to do about it?
Right. And I think at 1 year, it's a very different conversation at 1 year, because 1 year is 1 year. You know, things have just started. Word is just getting out, and, you know, the
network
hasn't built, all that kind of stuff. People are just learning about it. It takes time to sometimes ramp up. I think at a 5 year window, it's a very different conversation. I do believe someone from UNR is here now, so if you do want to get into specifics and put them under the gun.
No, honestly, I would actually like to hear from our institutions to hear what the culture's like. And I know every department will be different, mm-hmm. but holistically, how are we treating a degree or a program at year five if the FTEs are still not at the estimate? I would like to hear that.
Yeah, then I think there probably are institutional conversations that may need to be had, and you're looking then at the low yield report and things like that to figure out what's going to happen. But I think those are institutional conversations, and so you may need to hear from the institution.
Yeah, I would love to do that. If we could start with our folks in the north, maybe we'll start with our R1, move to TMCC.
All right. Provost Thompson, you're up.
Provost Thompson, did you hear the question?
I apologize. I did not.
Okay. So I'll have Regent Brown repeat it. Thank you.
Sorry about that. So when we're looking at these three reports, we were giving 1 year after a program was initiated, 3 years, and 5 years. And just looking at the UNR line, some of your classes didn't meet expectations in year one, but then a different set of classes exceeded expectations in year three. I'm wondering, what is the attitude towards a program that is being initiated at year one versus year five if it's not meeting expectations? Yeah.
So thank you for the question. So when we put together these projections, right, I mean, there's always, I'll start with this, there's a lot of enthusiasm from the faculty members and the people who want to put it together, so we always try and make sure we temper the projections. And then have a basis either on current student demand or program demand associated with a minor or other type of program going forward. We do monitor them, and I will tell you, at the first year, I don't really have much of an expectation. I mean, we just start the process. At the third and fifth year, we start having the discussion on either if we miss the projections, why we miss the projections, and what do we see in demand. And that's when we start actually interacting with the students also and understanding how they made the decision to be in the program. And then also, what is the cost of offering the courses going forward? And sometimes, I mean, there's always some cost, but sometimes it's a very marginal increase in our cost because faculty members are teaching the courses that we already have. I mean, we haven't hired new faculty to teach these courses, and it's meeting a student interest and demand. So it's not straightforward in all cases. But we are engaging and interacting with the programs as we see what the student demand actually is as we go forward. So it's very specific on the program and again, what we developed as we go forward.
And that totally makes sense. I just wasn't sure if there was, like, an ROI that was seen. And we've gone through it, right? You know, yeah. What's the cost? What's the, you know, I'm going to go back, workforce gap analysis. What's absolutely. The future job yeah, trajectory here? If all those things, if you look at it and said, hey, there is an ROI here, we just need more students to know about it or whatever, then you pivot and you advertise differently yeah, and you talk with the community colleges, and that totally makes sense. I'm just trying to understand the cultural aspect of this from each institution, because for us, I think that the Board of Regents has for years made decisions without data sets. And so, again, it is something that is hopeful because you have the personnel that wants it and we have a couple students that want it. But if the trajectory doesn't scale, then I'm just happy to hear that there is a conversation. And I know and I trust all the institutions to know this, but I am happy to hear from all the institutions to hear about their cultural approach to it. So thank you, Provost.
Thank you.
Chair Del Carlo, to you and through you to Regent Brown, thank you for the question. I think the cultural question is excellent, and I think the reason for that is culture varies very much from institution to institution and also from one program to another. When a community college with our scale tends to bring a new program forward, we often rely upon the existing assets that we have. So we wouldn't bring a new program forward unless we possess the faculty necessary to deliver that program with fidelity, the part-time instructors, the equipment, the facilities, the labs, and so forth. Very often we're bringing forward a workforce certification, a skills certificate to start perhaps in this area where there are already students in the lab, and now this is a new opportunity for them. When we bring something forward like geology, for example, as we just discussed, there may be many students in that classroom already, all of whom are taking geology as perhaps an elective for a different science major. And it's the question of how many of those can be recruited to become majors. And in some cases, you have a professor who has tremendous charisma and can ensure that there will be a pipeline of students. We recruit from the 100 level, truly. That is where we recruit our very often our majors. Because they are really captured by the content. In other cases, it can be a little more of a challenge. We've identified a workforce need, and we can see that there is a need in the community among industry or commerce for a particular major, and then trying to convince students that that is a viable path or that that path even exists is very often new to them. They may know of majors that are familiar in their lives, the interaction with professionals they see each day and perhaps their first, you know, 18 to 25 years, but they don't know about other kinds of jobs, like data science, for example. When we bring a program like that forward, we need to do more work to make that clear to them, that this is a viable pathway and they can be successful in a career there. As for the 1, 3, and 5 report, we do look at that closely. Every year my team and I sit down and we look at that line by line, all the way down the chart, and we work with the deans and the directors in those programs to identify where are the gaps, right? If they're above expectations, that's a celebration. We've done even better than we'd hoped. Students are attracted to that major, but in some cases where it's low or it's lean or it's not meeting the targets, we have to have conversations about that. How are we promoting it? How are we making students aware of this? And how can we connect them to a path that's successful for their career or their transfer possibly to a four-year institution? And so that's a little bit more legwork in the program. And again, that's where you have to recruit the best in terms of the instructors who are delivering that course, because they are the ones who will be that conduit. Often they're the only person the student interacts with in 1 week to the next is their instructor in the classroom. And so having a really charismatic instructor who can make that clear to them. Finally, for that reason, we stood up a faculty advising program. So we have professional advisors in our advising center, but we also have faculty advisors now. And that hybrid model has been common at many institutions for a long time. We didn't have that. But now that we do, we have over a dozen full-time faculty who are very excited about advising and who want to engage with students and show them those pathways forward. And so it's been a very successful model for us in the last 3 years to stand that up, and we're looking forward to seeing that continue.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate that.
I can jump in for Nevada State University, Sarah Fry, the provost. I wanted to add to what my colleagues said. We emulate many of their strategies that they just described. We have a couple of tools that we've been deploying that I wanted to share with you regarding this comment. First and foremost is a tool I know Regent Brown is familiar with. That is Lightcast. We just adopted a license to Lightcast. This is a tool that lets us mine job postings and mine iPads data to give us better ideas for student demand, what's already being offered in the region, and workforce demand. So my executive vice provost, Tony Shinta, has been working on adopting this tool to help us make better forecasts when we're making the enrollment predictions, so we're not just kind of guessing what we hope to be true, using our faculty's kind of aspirations for the program, but grounded a little bit more in data as we're making those decisions. And then that also comes to bear when we're trying to decide when to continue programs. So if we have a program that's still low enrollment, but we know the workforce need is really high, then we might invest more in marketing as opposed to a program that's enrollment is low, but there's also not a clear demand from the workforce that's unmet. So that plays into it quite a bit. We've also talked about dividing our course offerings into kind of four categories. There's a tool in business called the BCG Growth Share Matrix. This is from the Boston Consulting Group. And it basically says that you need to treat different parts of your portfolio differently depending on the role that they have. There's some rising stars that you need to nurture. There's some pet programs that you might want to protect. So, for example, our Deaf Studies program is unique. We're the only one in the region. It meets a very important critical need. And so we will, you know, not expect it always to meet enrollment targets because of the unique nature of that program and the students it's serving and the value it plays in the region. So I would say we have four different strategies depending on what type of program it is that we look at when it comes up to on those reports. And then finally, our campus is now piloting some direct marketing campaigns for particular majors. We haven't done that in the past, and so we've been particularly investing, you saw on the three-year report, our data studies program. Our data science program is now one of the programs we're doing direct targeted major marketing because we know that's not a program that necessarily exists in the high schools, and so it's a little harder to get enrollment to because students don't always take high school courses and know what career pathways in that major look like. So there's a difference between things that are familiar to high school students versus majors that they need a little bit more education as to the outcomes for.
That totally makes sense. Thank you. If any of the other four academic want to participate, if not.
This is Chris Hebe, UNLV Provost. I'll just say that in about the next agenda item, we're going to talk extensively about how we manage this culture on our campus. So it's a perfect segue.
Any other questions or comments? Okay, on new program review, that was an information-only item, so we'll go to item number 8, which is the existing program review. And with that, we'll go to Director of Policy, Tarina Caserta.
Thank you.
T-O, not T-A.
Caserta. Well, originally it was Caserta, but for the record, Tarina Caserta, Director of Policy. Originally, Caserta was a Caserta. So you're correct. We'll go with it. Okay, back on track. Before I present for information only the existing program review, I do want to take a moment. This is one of my favorite ARSA committees during the year because within this agenda alone, there before you shows a pathway of what program and program life cycle is. And in that, you can see that earlier in this committee, you were approving some new programs, organizational unit, which is one of the final steps that is taken in a program life cycle. And we did that at the beginning of this meeting. And then I talked to you about the planning report, which is by statute needs to be done. But the planning report is that first step. It's that, as I referred to it earlier, it's that wish list, right, of institutions planning. What is on the horizon? What do we need? What does our state need? What does our nation need? Globally, what is needed? And that is that planning report we already spoke about. And then Dave Singleton was up here talking about once a program is approved, it goes through the 1-3-5-year review cycle. And those were excellent questions that we had during his portion of this meeting. And now we're going to talk about the existing program review, which is provided in policy that on a 10-year cycle, existing programs should go through a full review process at the institution. And so we can look at the ARSA agenda and see how this entire life cycle works. And of course, when a program has been reviewed and analyzed and should be deleted or eliminated or deactivated, it comes back to this committee. And that's what you do, is you approve that deactivation or elimination. And how we make those decisions are part of the review process. And so before you today for your information is a report compiled from the institutions of their existing program review. So going back to this one is provided in board policy, Title 4, Chapter 14, Section 6. You know I'm director of policy, so I always like to say where it is in the handbook. That's where we live. And it provides the review of the programs from the universities and the community colleges on that 10-year cycle. It is to assure they're looking for the academic quality and to determine if the need, the student demand, available resources support the continuation of the program. And so the report before you is quite meaty. I absolutely love it. I read through it. I like to look at the numbers and then the narratives. But there's two summaries at the beginning of the report. The first summary is actually a description of all the new programs approved or eliminated or deactivated in the last year. It's just a nice summary. But then the next table is a summary of the descriptive statistics or characteristics of all of those existing programs that were reviewed. Remember, about every 10-year cycle, they're reviewed. The summaries for each program reviewed, the report is broken down by institution. The summaries will be a description of the program reviewed. That'll be the review process and criteria that's used in the review, the major findings of the review and conclusions, the part I like best, the next steps will be outlined, and then once again, the descriptive statistics. And so at this point, if there's any questions on the content of those reviews, then I would defer to the institutions to answer those.
Okay, and in the agenda item, it does say we're going to have a representative from UNLV and one from TMCC present the reviews conducted for at least one program at their respective institutions, and I see Jeffrey Alexander is ready to come up and do that. So.
Yes. So as provided by policy, two institutions each year will provide that review. And we're ready. So first we have TMCC Vice President for Academic Affairs, Jeffrey Alexander. Or they can fight for the mic. I'd be happy to. Thank you.
Is there slides for it?
Yes. Thank you. Chris Heavey, Executive Vice President and Provost of UNLV. We're going to I think we're up first in the slide order, so we'll go ahead and proceed. So thanks, and this speaks very much to what Regent Brown talked about in her last question about how we as a campus think about this basically fundamental responsibility to advance the slide. green button. There we go. And we're required to do this by both board policy as well as our accrediting agency, NWCCU. And this is slide kind of represents the broad set of things that we're thinking about in the program review process: quality assurance, mission alignment, continuous improvement, structured reflection, and very importantly, as Regent Brown mentioned, alignment of resources. And in thinking about alignment of resources, I think it's important to think both at the macro level, as provosts, we're all resource constrained and we're always asking the question of where should we be putting faculty resources and how do they align with student demand and workforce need, but also within programs, the issue of alignment and resources. And one of the things I think it's important for us to think about is that a curriculum is essentially a structured set of learning experiences designed to produce an intended outcome. And those learning experiences are delivered by human beings. And so alignment of resources also is very importantly making sure people within programs know what their part is in the broader curriculum and know what other roles that other faculty are playing. And so, for example, things like curriculum maps are crucial so that faculty know what they're supposed to be teaching so that the students can go on to the next course and we don't have duplication, et cetera. And I also think it's important for us to consider the fact that these are not like buildings. Programs are not like buildings. Programs are more like football teams, to use the UNLV metaphor that is we're in favor of at the moment, because essentially it's a bunch of people trying to work in coordination in a constantly evolving situation. And that does mean that we need to be constantly thinking about how all of these people are coming together to produce those intended outcomes. And so it has to be more than once every 10-year activity. It has to be continuous activity where we are thinking about how our programs are working together. And so we say that the 10-year review is mandated, but it's definitely not sufficient to be adequate to make sure that we're meeting the needs of our students effectively. And so we have changed our process quite dramatically in the last few years to move in the direction of national best practices by having a much more continuous review of programs. And we start by this event, we call it Data Palooza, where every year we have a large gathering of all program leaders where we present them their program-specific data. So they're seeing it on a yearly basis. They're basically getting handed a packet of data so that they can look at what are their enrollment trends, what is happening within their program that might indicate success or need for changes, and then making sure that we have the right team together to support it. And so we've done a dramatic reorganization of our academic affairs team over the last 3 or 4 years to bring together a great group of people to support this, because we have 200 different programs at UNLV. And so essentially, you can think about that, if we have to do them every 10 years, we're doing 20 programs a year. And if we're wanting to do it more frequently than that, this is a constant activity of program academic affairs team meeting with program leaders to give them the ongoing data so that they are reflecting on what's happening within their programs. And so essentially, we think of this as a timeline that happens incrementally over the 10-year period, where essentially at the beginning of it, we look at academic assessment plans and use it to say, what do you learn from your 10-year program review that can get fed into your academic assessment plans? And academic assessment can be understood as the assessment of student learning with the intention to improve it. We're constantly assessing student learning when we give exams, but the important question is, are we reflecting back on that data to make sure that we are improving how we're teaching to enhance student learning? And so then in years two through four, they submit their annual assessment reports. And then we've created something that's called an academic innovation meeting, where we sit down mid-year through this cycle to talk with program leaders. And I'm going to let my senior vice provost, Kate Corrigan, to talk about that. And then we basically go through this same cycle again over the next 5 years to so that when they get to program review, they're not just coming to this cold. They have a lot of data that they've looked at over the ensuing period to make sure that they can think deeply about what's going on in their program. And so we put together an amazing team to lead this work that's led by our Senior Vice Provost of Academic Affairs, Kate Corrigan, and her group. And so I'm going to hand it over to her now to talk about our academic innovation meetings and give you one specific program review very briefly. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Del Carlo, Regents, NSHE leadership and colleagues. I am Kate Corrigan, Senior Vice Provost for Academic Affairs at UNLV for the record. So it's a pleasure to be here talking about program review with all of you. I know it's a dry topic that not many people get excited about, but we do, and we care deeply about it. As you just heard from Chris, we think of the 10-year mandatory program review as part of a comprehensive data infrastructure that we have been working hard to build over the last several years. And so I want to spend a moment focusing on, I think my slide, whoops, I broke it, that was me, there we go, the big green button, Kate, right, there we go, there we go, all right. So one of the things that I wanted to spend a moment talking about is one of the newer pieces of that data infrastructure that we're building, and we call them academic innovation meetings. And these academic innovation meetings are sort of what they sound like. It's a moment to meet with a department and spend some time with them thinking about how their program is doing, how their students are doing, what those outcomes look like, everything from enrollment to graduation and student success and equitable outcomes. And at the end, to sit down with them and have this conversation in the context of no pressure, right? There's no evaluative measure here. There's no outside external evaluation, and there's no work required by the department. We provide them all of this data. So you can see, if you can see the slides, that we give them student success data from enrollment through graduation, retention. We give them degree and course level data. We go over exit surveys and employment outcomes of their own graduates in their programs. We look at feedback from their annual assessment reports, and we look at curricular assessment. How is their curriculum working, sequencing, et cetera? And so these academic innovation meetings then become an opportunity for meaningful conversation midway along the way to the 10-year review. In the process, we not only share all of that data with them for their own program and department and students, we share it for their college, for the university, and we disaggregate the data. Because one of the things we're focused on is not just outstanding programs and student outcomes that are improving, but we're looking for equitable outcomes and closing that achievement gap. So we disaggregate the data on the basis of race, ethnicity, gender, Pell eligible status, all of these really critical differentiators. So as in program review with our academic innovation meetings, the closing the loop is in many ways the most important thing. So the meeting is meaningful, the data is helpful, the discussion is hopefully at least somewhat transformative, but the key is the follow-up. And so you can see on the screen that after the academic innovation meeting, we meet with the department chair, we meet with the dean, we create the list of action items. Our incredible team in academic effectiveness gives them a list of campus supports and people and units to contact who can help them move forward on the challenges that we may have identified. So it's a really impactful process, and we're really excited to be rolling that into our 10-year program review sort of life cycle. Now, let's look at the 10-year program review process. It's probably pretty familiar to most folks in this room. We do our best to notify departments ahead, at least one semester ahead of their annual or their 10-year review process. In the first semester, they work with us and they draft a self-study. They identify their external reviewer or reviewer team. They conduct student surveys and faculty surveys, right? So they're really building that groundwork. The real action takes place in the second semester or so. Some of these take less than a year. Some of these take a bit more than a year, but in general, it's that second semester where they work with us to finalize the self-study. We have an evaluator, at least one, sometimes two, come to campus and spend a day or two with us, meeting with students, faculty, provost team members, etc., the dean, of course. We then, at the end of that visit, get a report from our evaluator, and we sit with that evaluator and hear from them as they're about to leave campus what their sort of first impressions are, strengths, challenges, etc. And then the important thing is we've added some critical critical steps after that. So once we get that final written report from the evaluator, we then schedule a meeting to sit with at least the dean or associate dean and the chair of the department, sometimes with other faculty too, to go over and take a moment to celebrate the successes that were identified, but also then to spend some time focusing on the challenges that emerged in the process. And that allows us the opportunity to close the loop and identify action items that sort of launch them on their next 10-year journey, right? Things that we can help them work on. So let's take a quick look at our BS in biochemistry 10-year review. At a quick glance, BS in biochemistry is a program that serves a really diverse student population. About 79% of the enrolled students identify as minority group members, and 47% of the students in this program are Pell recipients. There is a significant demand, of course, in Nevada and beyond for STEM graduates in the workforce. And according to NC employment data, we know that about 71% of the graduates from our BS in biochemistry program are employed within the first year in their field, right? And so our students are finding those jobs, and those jobs that 71% are staying in Nevada. So we're transforming not just students' lives and creating social mobility, but we're impacting the workforce and the economy of Southern Nevada. Biochem students also tend to go on to pursue degrees in dental medicine, in medical school, and other graduate programs at a fairly high rate as well. Now, when we look at the program, you can see if we take a quick look at program headcount. Headcount is based on fall-to-fall enrollment, and we had our lowest enrollment in fall 23 and our highest enrollment in fall 24, but over time, what you can see is that program enrollment has consistently grown, and in fact, we are up 24% since 2019, so we have significant growth in enrollment. We also then look at fall-to-fall retention, and this is a cohort analysis, which means we're looking at sort of first-year students who enter biochemistry, and what you can see on this is that we're looking at the Pell-eligible and the minority students compared to all students at UNLV. In the first bar chart, what you will see is that Pell-eligible and Pell recipient students in biochem do 5 percentage points higher, are retained at a higher rate than non-Pell recipients in this particular program. The second bar shows you another remarkable statistic, which is that biochemistry students retain at UNLV at an 86% rate, which is quite strong for first-year retention, and that is 7 points higher than the total cohort at UNLV when we look at minority students. And the third bar talks about student retention in that first year, and we see that overall retention of biochemistry is 8 percentage points higher than in other degrees at UNLV. So they're doing quite well on that front as well. Now, when we look at degree conferral, which is another really important metric, we would like to show you here that our biochemistry degrees have grown, and we are awarding 140% more since 2017-2018. So they're enrolling, they're retaining, but they're also finishing. So we're seeing a successful student life cycle in this program. Notably, I think you'll be interested to hear that 33% of our graduates from biochemistry in this last year were women. That is lower than the UNLV rate, but it is pretty respectable for a STEM discipline, right? And so we're always working on that. 33% of the students who graduated last year were adult learners who are 25 and over, and 67% of our biochem graduates in the last year were conferred to underrepresented minorities. So our students are finishing strong. Four-year graduation is almost identical to the overall campus rate at about 25%. And when we look at six-year graduation, we see some really notable things here, and that is that our students in biochemistry are graduating at a high rate in 6 years. So, for example, the 2018 biochemistry cohort had a six-year graduation rate of 66%, which is quite remarkable and higher than our overall UNLV. And 41% of those students graduated from biochemistry or the College of Science somewhere. So they were staying in basically the same discipline. When we break that out to see, do a check on our achievement gap, what we see is that our minority students are doing better than non-minority students in terms of graduation in biochemistry and compared to students at UNLV. So something is working well here. Now, we don't just look at the data, although it does point a very positive picture of a thriving academic degree program in biochemistry. We also look at how the program is aligned with our top-tier goals. And so I'm not going to go through these in great detail, but when we, you know, the data I just shared with you reflects the student achievement goal. We know that faculty in this program are highly research active. They do quite well in the classroom, and they do a lot of service. In fact, just last year, they had the Distinguished Service Award to a faculty member in biochemistry. They have lots of community partnerships, including internships and other kinds of activities that support student success. And as the data bear out, they are also very committed to social justice, equity, and inclusion. So, now, let's take a quick look at our external reviewer findings. So the external reviewer really brings fresh eyes and to look at the program, to talk to faculty, staff, and students. And so our reviewer was Dr. James Hoagland from Syracuse University. And Dr. Hoagland shared four real strong successes about the program with us. First, that the faculty are highly research productive. They have grants, they're publishing, and that this increases the quality of the program. Second, that students are satisfied with the quality and rigor of the program, which is always great to hear. That obviously there is robust and growing enrollment and positive student success outcomes, as you just saw, and that there's a strong job market. So these are all really great to hear from an external reviewer. But really, why we invite external reviewers is to hear this part. And this is, where can we do better? How can we grow? What do we need to think about? And so our external reviewer came back with four suggestions for areas that we could work on. One is what we like to call the universal reviewer lament, and that is that every external reviewer leads with, the department needs more faculty. And in many cases, that's true. And we did hear that here, that student enrollment is growing, that there is positive student success, and that there is room to add faculty to ensure continuity in these areas. Second, the reviewer noted some faculty structure issues, and that's specifically that our newest hires have been at the assistant level, junior faculty, and we have a lot of full faculty who are tenured and promoted, but we really don't have faculty in this department at that mid-tier, right, at the associate professor level. And this is a great example of a recommendation that we can act on. So next hire in this department, we can seriously consider doing so perhaps at the associate level to fill in that gap in the middle. Course sequencing arose as something that the reviewer recommend that we look at. This is sequencing of courses that students need, how frequently they're offered, and how accessible the courses that students need are to them so that they can graduate in a timely way. So that's something that you're going to see again in a moment. And lab spaces require some renovation and updating, which is something that we weren't surprised to hear. Now, students are really, you know, the gold standard. And so as much as we value what the external reviewer said, we really especially rely on student input here. And so we look to our juniors and seniors because those are the students with the most courses under their belt from biochemistry. And we had about a 21% student response rate to the survey. Students said very similar things. They were very happy with their faculty. They're strong researchers. They're great instructors. They like the program. They said it gives them great experience, it's challenging, they like the rigor. And they noted that advising was very helpful. And this was interesting because the reason advising was helpful is it helped them get around some of these course challenges, getting the classes they need in the sequence they need. So it echoed one of the concerns of the external reviewer. Students also said there are some things we could do differently or better, and we really appreciate that. Students are always fonts for inspiration and ways that we can improve. And so what they shared is that, you know, we could have more options for upper division chemistry courses. We could organize these courses better, the sequencing question. We could address some of the building and lab issues that students said were old and outdated. And I personally particularly love this one. They were unsatisfied because they didn't feel adequately prepared for quantum physics before they took PChem 2. And so it leads one to ask, is anyone ever really fully confident with their quantum physics? I don't know. But these students would like more, which is a great thing to hear. So in closing, biochemistry is really a great example, we think, of the reason we do the mandatory tenure review. It's not because it's mandatory. We check the box. But it's so much more than that, right? It's a moment for data-driven and subjective input from key stakeholders, faculty, staff, external experts, to assess both program strengths and challenges and to help us continually strive for program excellence, right? And so this really caps off 10 years of assessment, evaluation, data-palooza, all of the data-informed activities, including now AIM, that leads us to this 10-year review. And a program review with no challenges or opportunities for growth is frankly wholly unsatisfying and not very useful. It's the insights, ideas, and concerns that we hear in this process that truly drive both program innovation and improvement, and ultimately these are the pathway to more equitable student success. So I want to thank you for your time, and we'd be happy to quickly answer any questions you might have.
Any comments or questions? Regent Brown.
First of all, thank you. I love anything that is completely data-driven, and I think it makes a lot of sense to have annual checks, not just wait till the 10-year and have to, well, what did we do? That's why people keep, you know, records and stuff. When did the official AIM program get rolled out?
Last year.
So this is
mid-year.
This we're really talking about. This is kind of like this year is going to be the first year where we're doing a look back on, you know, the implementation of AIM, and people have known about it. So hopefully moving forward, this just grows and maintains, and this is this probably was already happening to a degree, but now it's laid out in a much more thorough,
yes,
meticulous way.
Exactly.
And so this is something that we could then look back and say, hey, UNLV, how is this going? What does the year over year look like? And then we can keep this in perpetuity, right?
So like, yes, it's absolutely a program we're committed to. So far, we've been very, very happy with those conversations and the impact, right? People go away with ideas about how to do things differently, and that AIM, those meetings come somewhere between years 4 and 7 or 8, right? So ideally enough time to have an impact before that 10-year, and then we start over.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'll say, I really appreciate you guys looking at the data of job trajectory, because I do think that NCHE as a whole doesn't do a good enough job at really valuing our economic impact to the state. Everybody knows, oh, you're the, you know, the job pipeline, but what is our actual impact? 71% of our taxpayer-subsidized education stayed in the state and added to the economy, which created X number of revenue, which created X number of jobs. Maybe they started businesses. And these are the types of data that I hope across the board we start taking better metrics of, because we need to be able to tell our story strong and not just say we're part of the state, but we're actually a value add in so many other ways. So thank you.
Yeah, and I was just going to add on the AIM. One of the things that I mentioned in my part of this presentation is it requires a lot of person power. And so one of the things we had to do is really hire the adequate staffing to do this. You can see that it's a labor-intensive process for hundreds of programs that were the 200 programs we're trying to do. And so really had to put in place the right structures, which took us a little while. It's not cheap.
No, I can't imagine it is cheap, but I think the ROI is very clear. And I think, you know, being able to judge year over year and not just wait until we get, I mean, think about the money that you spend on the staffing, but think about how much money we'd spend on a program after 10 years that isn't meeting its goals. And, you know, sometimes you got to spend money to be more effective. And I really appreciate that approach. So thank you.
Regent McDonald, do you have anything? Or, I'm sorry, McMichael. What's wrong with me today?
Thank you. I don't like to be the one to bring people down. I mean, I love these reports and the reviews that are being done. But how is this going to be reflective after January 20th? What are we looking forward to in a world, in a state that has to fund higher education 100%, because the federal government will no longer have the Department of Education. No Pell Grants, no student loans, no student aid. How is that going to affect the future of students getting their degrees in this state and going forward to a better job? Now, we haven't set up anything. Everybody's wondering and saying, well, we don't know. We can't predict the future. Well, you can predict the future. When the president-elect said, no more Department of Education, you have to now eliminate that as a source. And from this point on, until the next administration, whenever that will happen, you're going to have to sit down and tell students that what we used to do in the past, we can't do in the future. As of January 20th, do not count on any aid from the federal government for higher education. It's just not in the works. The president-elect has said it's going to be dismantled. So we need to be straight with our students. All of these reports that we have and we're expanding on today have no bearing after January 20th. So the students and their parents have to be aware of what's coming down. And I'm just saying, I hate to be the downer, but what are we looking forward to? And the students and their parents have to know. We have 2 months to at least come up with something. When a student comes to you and says, what are my prospects? I was planning on graduating in a couple of years. Now I have to consider, you know, moving into another doctorate that's going to be sustained, because what I was trying to get is going away because people can't afford it. They can't get a student loan.
Chair Del Carlo, I just started to interrupt and apologize for interrupting Regent McMichael. Just a reminder that we're still on agenda item 8, which is right. Existing review of programs, and I just would hate to deviate too far from the current agenda item that we're on.
Okay.
Thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Regent McDonald. And I'd like to say I thought you had a fabulous program review. I was sitting here thinking, gosh, this must be a best practice, what you guys have put together. But then I haven't heard the other 6 either. So, and we're only doing 2 today. But, I mean, you guys have just completely taken it, pulled it apart, examined it, and put it back together. It's really impressive because I was reading through some of the other board material, how UNLV's graduation rates continue to climb. And it's wonderful. You guys have record enrollment this year with almost 33,000 students. You're just, what, a couple hundred students shy, 100 students. And I look back, this is the core, the absolute core of what we do in these institutions. And so I'm really, really thrilled to hear what you guys have done. This has been a fabulous presentation. And to take those 200 courses, that is a lot of time and effort. But the payoffs, as you said, return on investment is there. And it is expensive to do this. But this is what you should be doing. And you are doing it. And I'm proud of you. And just keep up the good work. I mean, this is under your leadership, Provost Heavies. Wow.
Well, thank you so much. And I really want to give a lot of credit to Kate Corrigan, our Senior Vice Provost, and Lindsay Cousins, who's in the audience here, for leading this work. They have been incredible additions to our team.
Yeah, thank you. And Kate, you had gone over, you were from the Honors College before, or the, which college?
Graduate College.
Graduate College.
Yes.
Yeah, so you see how important all this is.
Absolutely.
For sure. And those of you that have joined us late, we got a lot of room in here. We're not quite done. Maybe you guys finished earlier in another meeting, but come sit down. Join us. Because we're going to hear from, thank you, excellent presentation. We're going to hear from Dr. Jeffrey Alexander now.
Thank you very much, Chair Del Carlo, Regent members of the ARSA committee. My name is Jeffrey Alexander, Vice President of Academic Affairs at TMCC, for the record. I'm very pleased to be here with you today. and to talk about our program unit review, PUR process. The program unit review process is important at TMCC. We have a long tradition of reviewing programs for that very reason. And we do the very sort of work that you've heard recently. So I'll skim past some of those elements because the data-driven aspect of this is key for us, and we, too, provide that data for our teams in an effort to ensure that they can do that work as efficiently as possible. Our team is lean and mean, and we deliver this with fidelity and regularity as well. We conduct this every 5 to 6 years. We want to identify this, basically the SWOT analysis, right? The strengths, weaknesses, opportunities, and threats. What can we do better? What are we doing well? What do we wish to maximize? And we weigh the resource requests very carefully in order to try to deliver for those programs and our students. Ultimately, this comes down to what is best for students, for their education, for the training they receive, and for their futures as they move on. And so this is a focus on continuous improvement. The cycle for us very clearly starts in the fall, and through the spring, the programs develop that report, develop it for their peers, for the academic and student affairs committee. So that together winds up being academic standards and assessment committee is the one that reviews that. So it isn't just the members of the department, but also their peers in adjacent programs. Very often, in the case of the program we'll explore together, psychology, they'll see that many of their students are in adjacent programs and taking psychology as it is a very popular course, as you might imagine, for students across the institution. Often it's a required course for many of their programs. And so this allows for shared governance. We have faculty participation from across the institution, and they therefore serve as captains of particular self-studies to help their peers to develop those studies very well and to act upon them as best they can. There are four steps in that program review process: the overview, right, the curriculum and program learning outcomes, the demographic and enrollment and student success trends, and the resources and the strategic planning. There's lots of detail in each section. All of them are important, but ultimately they are data informed. This is really key for us. We want to know who are our students, why are they coming here to this institution, what kind of outcomes are they experiencing, how are they performing, how can we do better in some of those regards. And this, of course, rolls up into our 5-year strategic plan and ultimately toward system goals, naturally. The data that we utilize is, of course, enrollment, which is FTE and headcount, sections offered, all of those sorts of things. Disaggregated program enrollment, this would be how many students who are underrepresented minority students, URM students, in our classes, and how are they performing? As a Hispanic-serving institution, we're very interested in that sort of data and their outcomes, too. The faculty, their workload, how are they performing? Are they asked to do just as much, too much perhaps in some cases, teaching overloads? Do they have the resources necessary to deliver and deliver well? The disaggregated student achievement data is really important for us. We want to see not how students are doing in the main overall, but also how are they performing individually as some of these underrepresented groups, and what do their outcomes look like? And for CTE and allied health programs, we want to ensure that we're meeting the goals and the metrics for DETR, as well as GOED and so forth, because very often they are helping to fund our programs through equipment and space and facilities and sometimes support for some of our instructors and our initiatives, and we're very grateful for that. And we wish to report that to them as well, and very often that's required. So the selected program we have for you today is our Associate of Arts in Psychology. We last reviewed this in 23-24. That was very fresh, and so we've just come off that cycle. And the 2 degrees reviewed were the Associate of Arts in Psychology, but also an AS. As you may recall, we just began an Associate of Science in Psychology, which we talked about when we met at DRI last, and that is just now getting underway. So we're very excited about that. But chiefly, this is about the Associate of Arts. The data here, very tiny, but very important, and we look at it closely. These are just samples for you to be able to appreciate the level and the granular detail that we're getting into here when we look at the majors and the outcomes that we have, the various student groups that we have, how they're enrolling and so forth. Disaggregated by gender, perhaps. In this case, we have more female students than male. Quite a swing from 40 or 50 years ago, when in many cases at colleges and universities, the majority of students studying psychology were male, and indeed the majority of students very often were male. So this is quite a swing. It's now seen as a deficit, perhaps, on the side of male students, but this is an area that we track. Hispanic male completion, for example, course completion, program completion, how do they perform, and how do they compete against other programs, in some cases, other classes. Course completion, this would be all psychology students. So again, another example and some sample data here to show the types of analyses that these faculty and the committee together are taking. Transfer is a big part of what we do, particularly with psychology, as this is a big transfer program for us. We'll see that out of 100 total students, out of 100% here, total transfer graduates are 85, and 71 of those were transfer graduates to an NCHE institution, 14 to non-NCHE institutions. So the predominantly moving on to four-year institutions here in Nevada, chiefly UNR. And the students who are meeting or exceeding the program learning outcomes. We are in the midst now of developing and scaling up our assessment of program-level learning outcomes. When we ask our programs, what is it your graduates can do when they cross the stage? What is it they know? What are they prepared to do next? And let's work backwards and identify what are those key program-level learning outcomes. Every course has learning outcomes. How do they roll up together and scaffold together to build that programmatic growth? And so we see key concepts here for the students to master, advantages for basic research methods and so forth, and do they understand those, aspects of individual or cultural diversity and ideas and so forth, scholarly works and basic concepts and principles. These are the fundamental building blocks for the program in psychology. And the findings here, the strengths, we're happy to celebrate very strong leadership from the department chair, Haley Orthor-Clark, who does tremendous work here in her team together. This is a vital transfer program for us. We find that the outcomes are well aligned with UNR's expected anticipated learning outcomes and also getting them prepared for the next steps. The department is proactive in ensuring that the instructional materials are accessible. They've also jumped on OER content, which is open educational resources, or free, very often, no or low-cost digital materials. This enables better access. It is, of course, enabling students to get into classes, stay in classes, persist in their studies because they can afford to be in the room because the textbook doesn't cost $200, right? Now we have great open educational content. Students can access that, and that helps them to enroll and persist in their programs. We have faculty who have participated in that program extensively. The program is well scaffolded, and the faculty are well engaged in discussing those program-level learning outcomes with their teams and their students. And the completion rates are comparable to the division and higher than those of the college broadly. So we're very proud of that. Opportunities for improvement. Again, this is why we do this. As we heard from our colleagues at UNLV before, this is what really matters. We're always trying to improve. And so we found that faculty continued to teach overloads. Often this was a product of, as we've seen, economic times rise and fall. The pandemic was challenging, and there were staffing challenges as well. But the department has pitched in, and many instructors have taught an additional class or two to keep the program moving forward and the students succeeding. So it's reflective of national trends, but we do see an equity gap among males, as I mentioned. There are slight gaps in course completion for males and Hispanic students, so we're working on that, want to identify the reasons and trends there. And we have a five-year plan for future needs for more concrete actions and timeframes. The recommendation was to continue to study OER as an option for our students, to develop a curriculum map, which will show the students where they go next and make their way through the program and on to their next phase. And to identify improvement plans around assessment of the program learning outcomes, of course, to plan to address the male equity gap and develop more concrete actions and timeframes around the five-year plan so we can achieve those goals together and to certainly validate those requests for resources. This is really key for us. If faculty work so hard on a program unit review and then it just goes and sits on a shelf somewhere and gathers dust and we don't do anything about it, it's naturally deflating. It doesn't feel like we've done anything valid. It feels like busy work. We want to make sure that's not happening. And so my office makes a point to meet with the authors of those studies once the entire process is complete. After everyone has seen it, the committee, the dean, myself, we've all commented on that review. We sit down together and bring it to resolution, right? Where are we going next? Where do you see your program in 3 to 5 years? What resources can we provide? And in many cases, very often, as we've heard before, it's a faculty member or two that is requested, or facilities, space, perhaps renovations, equipment, and so forth. And so for us, the celebration came this year when we fulfilled, indeed, that faculty's, that program unit review's request for a new faculty member and hired a full-time tenure-track faculty member in psychology who is terrific and is very much celebrated by the program. They are very pleased to bring him aboard, and they're delighted with his performance and his teaching, and the students are too. And so this is an example of closing that loop, ensuring that we've actually heard what the faculty have to say. It's been assessed and reviewed by their peers, by the dean, by my office, and then we've done our best to deliver. And then we bring that back to them at the committee to demonstrate that here are the program unit reviews that you worked on that we then endeavored to fulfill when it came to the resources that were needed. And we were happy to do that this year in several cases. More than a dozen faculty members were brought aboard this year in the fall, and in many cases in direct response to those requests that were validated by this process. And so we're very happy to know that when our accrediting body comes to town and they ask, how do you align resources with need? We can say, this is how we do it. And we can demonstrate that the outcomes were fulfilled. And so that is my very short précis on the Associate of Arts in Psychology and in the context of program unit review. I'm happy to take any questions.
Okay, excellent presentation. Any questions or comments? Yeah, okay, Regent Brown.
So I really appreciate the, you made a point to say that you work with employers, local employers, to make sure that your training, the training needs are fitting what they need. I think that's so important. I also see that you do this in a 5 to 6 year where UNLV presented a 10 year, and that makes sense since you graduate people on a 2 year basis. So I'm just saying things that make sense. But I wanted to ask actually, so this was nice to see kind of like the culture breakdown of how the assessment happens. And when you look at the existing program report that was presented at the top of the agenda item, I did notice one thing, and I wanted to just point it out, but then have follow-up comments. So I noticed that at TMCC, you guys actually had way more programs than other schools that actually were eliminated and deactivated. And what I want to say is I actually am happy to see that, because that tells me that you guys are trying things, you're pivoting, the assessment is working, and you're not just prolonging things. So I wanted to say that I noticed that, and I actually think it's a positive reflection. I am curious, I probably should have asked you what that meant before I gave my own opinion, but I just think as you're growing and scaling any new thing, if it's not working, deactivate it, move on to the next, hire, fire, fast, right? Like that's how I'm talking from a company perspective. That's how they grow and that's how they get stronger. But in this case, sunsetting something that's just not working and then pivoting to something working with employers. So I'm curious if that was kind of the mindset behind this and if I'm reading the data sets right.
Thank you, Chairlor Carlo, 2 and 3 to Regent Brown. I really appreciate that question. Yes, that is the meat and potatoes very often of what we're trying to do when it comes to program growth and development, and in some cases, moving on. We meet prior to this meeting as the academic officers every quarter, and we sit down and have those very conversations. When is it time to move on and decide that a program perhaps is no longer either needed or needed in quite that way? When can we fold programs together? When can we take certain courses that need to persist and add them to something different and then sunset that particular dimension of the program? Again, we work with the assets we have, and we have a great cohort of faculty very often in these program areas. With they sunset one program and maintain two others or bring something on later on. This enables us to work with the same team, very often the same equipment, the same resources, but to continue to be flexible. And in the case, for example, of Diesel Tech, we looked at some new programs in that arena because we listen to the employers who are part of our advisory board. And they come to us certainly every semester, sometimes more than once, and they sit down with us and they talk to us. And they'll tell us what's working, what do the students know really well, what do they need to add. They need additional training in this or that in order to be successful right out of the gate when they hire them and they bring them aboard to their companies. And the feedback loop that we get from them is so important and so strong. So that feeds very often the conversations we have at the 1, 3, and 5 report that we examine together, the low yield report that we examine together, and when there are proposals for new things, we want to know, is this what the employers want? Or is this what the transfer program pipeline demands? Are we missing something here? Last year, a couple of years ago, we brought forward an Associate of Science in Agricultural Science because we noticed that almost 10% of the STEM majors at UNR were in Ag Science. We didn't have that, but we had many of the building blocks necessary to make it happen. And so we were very happy to work with UNR and put together a transfer program that would enable students to make their way to the university. So these are the kinds of program conversations that we're having all the time. And yes, they very often inform this program unit review process too.
Regent McMichael, do you have anything? No. Okay. And I just wanted to know, if when you talked about there's not so many male students going into psychology, is that a national trend? Because you said it changed from way long ago. I get that because, But what's, do you know the national trend on that?
That's actually a great question. And in fact, overall in the aggregate, there are many more female students in many of these gen ed programs than male students currently. This is a national trend indeed. Extrapolated out to the very end, some have predicted that there will be no more men in college by the year 2040 or 50 or what have you. We know that isn't really true, but if that trend line were maintained, so of course that's why we're looking at how do we reverse that trend line sometimes. We find some traditional occupations are difficult to swing over. In some cases, nursing is a good example of one that has changed in the last 20 years, perhaps 25. But others are slower to change, and some have swung almost too far in the other direction. And so programs are always mindful of these kinds of shortfalls, perhaps, in certain student group populations, and they'd like to try to correct them if they can.
Thank you. And I think it was a wonderful review, and you guys are spot on, and everything you're doing is working well for your college, and excellent report, and I appreciate the detail of everything.
Thank you, Chair Del Carlo.
Yeah, thank you very much. So that brings us to item number 9, which is new business. Do we have any new business? Regent Brown.
Regent Brown, for the record, thank you. I would actually like to see, for the existing program report, I'd like to see an aggregated data set to include the 1, 3, and 5 for that existing so we can see the trajectory.
Okay. Regent McMichael?
Yes, I would like to see a committee put together to answer one question that should be unified throughout the system. What will happen when the Department of Education disappears?
Thank you. Let me shut that off.
Public comment, Jim.
Yeah, I was just changing my paper. With that, we'll go to public comment. Is there any public comment here in Las Vegas? Is there any public comment on the phone?
There is one caller on the phone.
Okay. Please state your name and spell your last name for the record. And you have 3 minutes, correct?
Press star 6 to unmute. They're not unmuting. It may be for next meeting.
Okay. Regent McMichael, did you have a comment? And yes. If you do, please go to the podium.
Okay. This one? Yes. My name is Donald McMichael, McMichael. And my public comment is, I'm worried. I'm absolutely worried as to what is going to happen as of the 20th of January, and we don't have anything set in stone as to how we're going to address the fact that the Department of Education is gone. And I know that people out there have been asking, they've been asking me questions. I don't have a concrete answer for them other than to tell them that if there was any aspect of federal funding that touched the state of Nevada and it was related to the Department of Education, it's gone. All right, so student loans, Pell Grants, student incentives to get help from the federal government, it's gone. So I don't like to wait until the 21st of January to tell people that, hey, if your paperwork hasn't been in and approved for a federal loan, be prepared that there are going to be a slew of companies that will come into existence that will try and make as much money as they can offering high interest rates to students who wish to fulfill their educational requirements, and we must be prepared for these companies that will come into existence and will try and prey on our students and their families, and we have to be prepared for that. Thank you.
Is there any other public comment? And seeing none, I declare this meeting ended, and we've made up about 10 minutes. So have